All right, welcome back from the break. I am very excited now to introduce a panel of six distinguished guests who will be discussing meat replacement and meat alternatives. Before getting into it, I want to let you all know that we've got a bigger and better system for audience Q&A than we did yesterday. Today, if you go to the website at eaglobal.org and navigate down to the schedule and find this particular event, there will be a link on the website, which you can just tap in on your phone, and it'll open up the Q&A. You can input your Q&A there. There's upvoting and downvoting, and toward the end of this discussion, we'll have a chance to bring some of your questions to our panelists. So when we think about meat, why do we think about meat? Well, first of all, there are 7 billion animals at any given time in the world, generally living in pretty awful conditions. That is a source of massive suffering. Exactly how much and how we should think about it is one of the questions that our panelists will address for us today. But in addition to the fact that there are 7 billion sentient organisms living in some sort of conditions that we would generally find unacceptable, 70, I've got 7 billion, but I'll take your correction, 70 billion living at any one time. This is also a major source of global greenhouse emissions, which is unto itself a completely critical issue. So if we could make meat alternatives that were cost and taste competitive, we might be able to drastically reduce both the effect on the environment and the suffering that animals go through. But is that feasible? This panel will address that question and help us find out. First, I'd like to introduce our moderator, Claire Zabel. She is a research analyst at GiveWell and the Open Philanthropy Project, and a board member at Animal Charity Evaluators. She graduated with distinction with a BS and an MS in Earth Systems, and honors in ethics in society from Stanford University. Please welcome Claire Zabel to moderate the panel. Next is Lewis Bollard. He leads the Open Philanthropy Project's research and strategy on farmed animal welfare. He previously worked as a policy advisor to the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States and a consultant at Bain & Company. He's a graduate of Harvard College and Yale Law School. Please welcome Lewis Bollard. Next up, Isha Datar is the CEO of New Harvest and co-founder of Mufri and Clara Foods. New Harvest is a 501c3 advancing breakthroughs in cellular agriculture, the science of producing agricultural products such as meat, milk, and eggs from cell cultures. Isha is a cell and molecular biologist with a master's in biotechnology from the University of Toronto. Please welcome Isha Datar. Bruce Friedrich is next. He is the executive director of the Good Food Institute, which you can find at gfi.org. That's a nonprofit organization that promotes plant-based and clean, that is, grown without the culture or slaughter of animals, alternatives to conventional meat, dairy products, and eggs. Bruce graduated magna cum laude from Georgetown Law and Phi Beta Kappa from Grinnell College. Please welcome Bruce Friedrich. Tobias Lienert is next. He is the founder of the Belgium-based Ethical Vegetarian Alternative and the blog Vegan Strategist. He focuses on ending animal suffering for good and is writing a book called How to Veganize the World in 30 Years. He aims to help animal advocates be as effective as they can be. Please welcome Tobias Lienert. And last but not least, Allison Smith. She is the director of research at Animal Charity Evaluators, an organization dedicated to evaluating the impact of charities which work to improve animal well-being. Allison has been involved in the ACE research efforts since May 2013 and joined the ACE team in August 2013. She has degrees in mathematics from Carleton College and Northwestern University. Please join me in welcoming Allison Smith.
Great. Thanks, everyone. So I'm just going to quickly tell you about the goals of the panel, and then we're going to talk about the expertise of each of our panelists here, and then get into some questions. So the kind of overall broad goal of this panel is to try to answer the following questions, which are: how far away is a product that truly replaces meat for the average American? So something that's appealing to most people, cost competitive, tasty, healthy, et cetera. And what are the challenges, the technical challenges to getting that? And then also I think maybe we'll dig into the kind of political and social challenges. So how can we get consumers to accept lab-grown meat or other types of animal product alternatives? And you know, who's working on this problem? How can more people be working on it? And what are the most productive projects for those people to do? So I think I want to start out by just asking each of the panelists to talk about what they specialize in. And then we can move on to some questions. So let's start with you, Tobias.
Okay, lately I've been a blogger at veganstrategist.org, and I basically focus on the question whether it will be mainly moral arguments or technology that will get us to where we want. And in the traditional vegan animal rights movement, there's a very heavy focus on moral arguments and moral campaigning. And I've been a bit of the opinion that we should have like a very big focus on actually on developing alternatives, because alternatives would make it easier for people, would facilitate the moral reasoning and the compassion for people.
I'm at the Open Philanthropy Project, where we are focused in the farm animal sphere on doing whatever we can to reduce the suffering of the billions of animals mistreated every year globally. And we see kind of two pieces to that. One is what we can do to reduce the suffering of each animal. And so we've been supporting corporate reforms and campaigns along those lines. But the second piece is reducing the number of animals who are suffering. And that's where this discussion comes into play, and how we can have technologies that ultimately alleviate the need to have animals suffering at all in the first place.
Hi there, my name is Isha Datar. I'm the CEO of New Harvest, which is a 501c3 research institute trying to build the field of cellular agriculture. We believe that the best way to get to a cultured meat product is to build a nice strong foundation in academic research. And if we can keep that research fairly open, we actually create many opportunities for companies to sprout out of them. So an example of a project that we're funding right now is establishment of the first chicken cell line, such that researchers around the world can have access to this chicken cell, so that there'll be many, many people working on cultured chicken to distribute the research. So our work is very much focused on scientific strategies to design our research field.
My name is Bruce Friedrich, and I'm executive director of the Good Food Institute. The Good Food Institute uses markets and food technology to disrupt animal agriculture. So the brainstorm of the Good Food Institute is that when people are actually making their food purchasing decisions, the factors that matter are taste, price, and convenience. So we have four program areas, all of which are focused on making plant-based and clean meat alternatives as delicious, as cost-competitive, and as convenient as possible. And I would encourage people to find out about our program initiatives and what we're up to at gfi.org on the web. And I imagine we'll be talking about a little bit more of it in the next hour.
I'm Allison Smith. I'm the director of research at Animal Charity Evaluators. So that job is a generalist job within the field of animal charity. We're looking to help the largest number of animals that we possibly can. So that means there's a heavy focus on animal farming as one of the issues that we want to address. But I look at all kinds of programs, from cleaner cultured meat to vegan advocacy to the kinds of corporate and humane reforms that Lewis has made grants for, and try to weigh and prioritize each of them against each other, particularly as funding opportunities for individual donors.
Great. Thanks for that. I think that was helpful. So I think I want to lead by kind of asking, you know, we're here at a conference that's about effective altruism, and a lot of people here are probably wondering how they can do as much good as possible, how they can allocate resources as effectively as possible. And so I was wondering, how do each of you who care very much about reducing animal suffering think about whether to go down more traditional lines of farm animal welfare advocacy or vegan advocacy, or put marginal resources into developing better animal product alternatives. What sort of considerations come into play, and how have all of you made that decision and come to some different decisions? Let's start with you, Allison.
So a big concern for me is the kind of resources that I'm in charge of directing. So Animal Charity Evaluators does not make grants and is not like a venture capital fund. All we can do is direct the donations of individual donors who may or may not do exactly what we want them to do. There's a coordination problem out there that we are only a small piece in solving. So for me, there's a lot of opportunities in the field of clean and cultured meat that are not appropriate funding targets for us just straight from the get-go for that reason. And so I'm looking mainly for opportunities to do something where I wouldn't expect it to be a good funding opportunity for a venture capitalist. And on the other hand, it doesn't need a really precise amount of money in order to get going or have a really firm cap on how much money it can use, because I may not be able to direct that minimum amount of donations, or on the other hand, I might direct way more than that maximum amount of donations if I made a recommendation to fund this project.
Yeah, so the Good Food Institute was the brainchild of Nick Cooney and Nathan Runkle, and it was founded as an explicitly EA charity. And one of the observations of Nick and Nathan, they looked at what Hampton Creek Foods and Beyond Meat and Impossible Foods were doing. So those companies have now raised more than $200 million, and they're valued at over $2 billion between the three companies. And they're focused on competing with conventional meat, dairy, and eggs, specifically based on the factors that go into people's decision-making process with regard to what they eat. And they looked at the fact that, for example, plant-based milk is currently at about 9% of the milk market, and plant-based meat is at about 0.25% of the meat market. So just getting to parity, just getting plant-based meat to parity with plant-based milk would save about 1 billion land animals every single year and more than 2 billion sea animals. And all of that money, all of that $200 million that went to those three companies was money that would not have otherwise gone into philanthropy, and yet all of it is focused on decreasing the number of animals who are consumed. So three of our four program areas, fostering innovation, we've actually started two new companies that have raised $550,000. We have half a dozen other companies that are in the pipeline. Supporting innovation, so working with especially startup companies, but also helping some further along companies with things like press releases and communication strategy. And then our institutional engagement, all of it is focused on being exponentially effective. So taking the resources that come into us and multiplying those resources through the work that we're doing.
We operate a few steps before GFI comes in. So we want to create the experts that go on to become the companies that GFI would be supporting, for example. So what I guess from my three years of focusing on cultured meat research, the first year I observed that there is definitely a vibrant community of experts out there who are ready to dive into this work. But what is missing are the resources. And that resources means two things. On one hand, it means funding, which is something that we are always trying to direct to research projects that we think will be the most catalytic. But also secondary, a missing resource are research resources, so research tools. People do not have access to the appropriate cell lines, media, areas of expertise. Usually we don't actually see agriculture schools and biomedical schools collaborating because they tend to be in separate facilities. So we try to work with institutions that have those things combined. For example, North Carolina is a great place because the research triangle is there, and there's a lot of biotech, but there's also a lot of agriculture. So we're trying to stimulate places that are already agriculture, biotech centers to focus on this type of research because we think it will advance the most quickly there. And for us, the greatest missing piece is funding for research projects, because biotechnology is extremely expensive and maybe a little bit different kind of philanthropy than most animal-oriented philanthropy, money-wise.
So I think as effective altruists, we always have to ask, where is our comparative advantage in doing the most good? And if you're a scientist, if you're an entrepreneur, I think the answer right now is probably going into the clean meat, cultured meat technology or the plant-based alternatives technology. I think there's a huge amount of opportunity there. As a philanthropy, the Open Philanthropy Project, I think, has a comparative advantage of being able to bring funds to neglected areas. And, you know, we have these three criteria of importance, tractability, and neglectedness. The importance is very clearly there, both for the immediate suffering of animals and for the long-term problems that plant-based technologies can solve. And we also think there's real tractability on both sides. The decision we've made in the short run is that we see more neglect of the traditional approaches to animal advocacy, to corporate campaigning, to the things that can get incremental reforms now, and relatively less neglect, though still relatively underfunded, on the plant-based technology side. So that's why we've been focusing there, but we definitely think there's a need on both sides of those, and I think that for each of you as effective altruists, the question will be, where's your comparative advantage in this field?
I came here with the plane from Europe, and somebody could tell me that the plane is a very polluting thing to do. Flying is a very polluting thing to do, but in order for me to use the alternative, which is to take the boat, I would have to be extremely motivated. I would have to be like very morally engaged, committed to do that, and to take 6 days instead of like 6 hours. And I think what would happen is that our moral arguments would become so much more strong and more convincing when we have good alternatives, very good alternatives, very similar alternatives, very available, very cheap, very healthy, environmentally sustainable, etc. And I think the problem right now is that people are too much of a stakeholder, stake with EA. So they're stakeholders in the sense that they have a stake in the meat and eating meat, and that makes it so hard for them, for the moral arguments to be credible to them. So that's why I believe we have to really invest in cultured meat, in alternatives, in more traditional alternatives, so that the advocacy work of the advocacy groups will become much easier in the future. I think the main challenge is to lower the dependency on the use of animals. We are too dependent on using animals right now, I think, as a culture and as individuals, for us to make very much headway with the moral arguments. So that's why I think a significant amount of our resources should go to developing the alternatives.
Thanks. I kind of want to pick up on something you said. It seems like you're highlighting some potential ways in which traditional animal activists and people that work on animal product alternatives can be really strong allies, and they can help each other. People that do farm animal welfare activism can create a market for these products or strengthen the market, make more people interested in them. And at the same time, people that work on animal product alternatives have the ability to make it much easier to and make these moral arguments look much more convincing and much less costly. What do you think a kind of ideal collaboration between these two groups would look like, and how do we get there?
Yeah, I think one of the possible ideas that it could be would be that, I mean, first of all, the animal advocacy movement, the animal rights movement, has to promote the products that are developed by the production side or the research side. So we have to be really in favor of cultured meat, and there is unfortunately still, I think, a relatively significant segment of the animal rights movement that has doubts, that is saying these products are not vegan and whatever. So we have to be really standing behind them 100%, I think. And we could be like the ambassadors of these products. We could be like even the promoting team, the promo team of these. I could see like a collaboration where like the animal rights activists, which is like a huge army of people, they could like go out in the streets and make people taste, like shove it down their throats, so to speak, taste these products that are developed by these companies. So that could be one way of structurally collaborating.
Could I add something about collaborations?
Yes, please.
I think a collaboration that maybe doesn't get discussed too much is collaborating with the existing meat industry. And something that we recently held a workshop where we had people from huge meat companies like Tyson talking about how our goals are the same as their goals. And yes, we all have to figure out how to feed 9 billion people by 2050. And I think that it's very important to bring these companies into the conversation very early, because they are so much part of the conversation. And that's why actually New Harvest avoids saying things like disrupt or change, because it's not so much disrupt, it's more about evolution of what meat can be.
Yeah, the Good Food Institute absolutely agrees with that, and we take great solace. It was pretty interesting. In January, Meeting Place magazine, which is a meat industry trade journal, meat is spelled M-E-A-T, and the editor's letter, so the first thing that people were reading when they got their latest issue of Meeting Place magazine was titled, Hormel's Next Acquisition. And it was encouraging the meat industry to follow people like Li Ka-shing and Bill Gates and Sergey Brin. And it was in favor of both plant-based meat and clean meat. And it was arguing that the meat industry itself should put R&D resources as well as merger and acquisitions resources into becoming a leader. So the GFI's fourth program area is institutional engagement. And that has to do with outreach to science foundations and government and corporations, really any organization or entity that purports to care about global health or climate change and the environment or global poverty and sustainability, and educating them about the value of both research and development and mergers and acquisition if they're corporations. So going to Tyson and saying, who better to do a plant-based or a clean meat chicken than Tyson? Who better to do going to Smithfield and saying the same thing about pork and so on? So could not agree more.
I would add that I think that the technological opportunities here are incredibly exciting. I mean, this is one of these areas where there is really the potential for a technology to actually solve at least the problem of farm animal suffering. But it's not going to be self-actuating, and it's also not inevitable. And so I think it's easy for us to just assume this will happen, you know, in 20 years we'll have cultured meat or clean meat and all the problems will be gone, and we can focus on other areas. And, you know, I think that both we need to be heavily involved on the technological side to make sure that actually happens, and in parallel, we need to be heavily involved on the moral side and the advocacy side to make sure we're alleviating suffering in the meantime, and we're creating the conditions that ensure the acceptance of these kind of products if and when they do get to market.
I absolutely agree. So 2 days ago was actually the third year anniversary of the cell-cultured hamburger being tasted. And at that time, there was, you know, estimates thrown out that cultured meat would be here in 5 years, which means that we are 60% of the way there. But in reality, we're not, because the technology, we have this assumption that the technology is moving itself along. But it really isn't, because it is, you know, at this intersection of food science and medical science, and it's a very neglected area. And I think if we do want to achieve these timelines, we have to attach to them 5 years and $50 million, or 5 years, $50 million, and 50 researchers, because it's not just about time at all.
Yeah, I was gonna sort of build on something Tobias said earlier that I think dovetails nicely with what you just said, Isha. In terms of activists, if you have the capacity to start one of these companies or to join one of these companies, or you're early in your career and you can go, you know, become a tissue engineer, and you have the, you know, cognitive capacity to be really good at it, we definitely need mission-driven people. We also need money. New Harvest and GFI are both fundraising. But so an awful lot of things that people can do even outside the traditionally activist community that would be hugely helpful to advancing this cause. One last thing is just plant-based meat is not actually that much further along than clean meat. It's, as I mentioned earlier, it's about 0.25% of the meat industry, so it's a little under $500 million against a $200 billion a year meat industry, which is about a 40th the size of plant-based milk. So I think it really it has a long way to go as well. Those of us in the veg community might point to, you know, Beyond Meat and Tofurky and feel very satisfied, but it is almost as nascent as clean meat.
I would agree with that. I also think that we should be thinking about cultured and plant-based as a continuum, as opposed to two discrete, you know, areas of two discrete types of products. So for example, as we there are combinations of plant-based and cultured elements that could actually move us closer and closer towards a most accurate meat.
Agree. Yeah,
that's a good point. So I guess we've touched on timelines a little, and I want to dig into that a little more. When will we start to see animal product alternatives that are good enough that we really start to see significant proportions of the suffering from animals on factory farms disappearing? And what needs to happen concretely for that to be the case? Is it more of a technological problem, a funding problem, a like advocacy and marketing problem? What sorts of timescales are we looking at, and what sorts of goals need to be met along those timelines?
All of the above.
I think we're kind of observing this data as it's being created right now. I got to taste the Impossible Burger at David Chang's restaurant earlier this week. And we haven't seen a product launch like that before. So they're trying something completely different. So we can't exactly go back and look at how other products were, emerged onto the market and how they took up more market share until we kind of see how these products do and learn from them.
I think it's, back on plant-based milk, I think it's instructive to see how they went from basically zero market share to almost 10% market share. Mm-hmm. And it didn't have to do with convincing people that it was ethically problematic to consume milk. It had to do with using markets and food technology. And GFI is looking at what happened with plant-based milk and attempting to replicate it. And a part of it is, I think we have some pretty good plant-based meats now. But the people in the plant-based milk community still talk about how a rising tide lifts all boats. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to the CEO of White Wave, he's talking about how Ripple will be a boon to White Wave, which is a little counterintuitive. I think a lot of people would see, sort of Ripple as perhaps a competitor with White Wave. But they still think, even at 9% of the market, that they're creating a market sector whereby advertising for White Wave helps Ripple, advertising for 365 soy milk helps all of them, and so on. I think we're absolutely there with plant-based meat as well. So we need more of these companies generating more buzz. And then the third of the project areas at GFI, a part of it is reaching out to grocery chains to move the plant-based meat from the nether regions of the grocery store. Because they mostly have them, but you have to really want them, and you have to go there, and you have to go out of their way. So we're looking at ways to get end caps. We're looking at ways to do promotions and the way that they do meat promotions and that sort of thing. And when I said all of the above, I was, on the one hand, it is all of the above. On the other hand, I was really quite serious.
Yeah, I think looking at dairy is a very, very good example, especially because nuts are allergens, and people often bring up things like, what about the safety of these alternatives? But these dairy alternatives are doing so well, even though they potentially have allergens and things like that, which shows that you can introduce these varieties to all kinds of audiences.
There has been research where they gave test participants the same product, and they said, this is meat and this is vegetarian. But they were both vegetarian or they were both meat, but people were tasting the same products, and they would always say that the meat product was better, even though they were the same product. Mm-hmm. So I'm just saying that the question of how similar or how perfect these products should be is not just a matter of similarity, but it is a psychological question also, and a branding and a marketing question. So, of course, we can see today that for many of us in this room, the products are already good enough. So, and we may wonder how much better should they get? And I think as much as focusing on further product development, we should really also focus on branding, marketing, and changing the ideas about meat and the associations that go with meat and that go with vegetarian products.
One.
And also using dairy as an example shows that similarity isn't necessarily exactly where you want to be aiming. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the plant-based dairy, people will be making choices to drink almond milk or coconut milk because they like the taste of the almond milk or the coconut milk more than they like the taste of the dairy milk. Mm-hmm. It's a different flavor, but it's a good flavor, and it goes with whatever they wanted to eat it with or drink it with. And so similarly, you don't necessarily need a perfect facsimile of animal meat. you need something that fills that same role on a plate mm-hmm. and tastes good on its own, and that you've marketed so that people understand it's going to taste good.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the most exciting and neglected areas in this right now is what we can do in China on this front. China already accounts for about half of the world's grower pigs at any point in time, about a quarter of the world's broiler chickens, a quarter of the world's layer hens, perhaps as much as half the farmed fish, we don't really know. And there's also, it's a country with hugely growing demand. The majority of increased meat demand will come from China. But there's also a real head start there. There's a tradition of accepting meat as being part of a dish, but not necessarily the center of a dish. And there's a willingness to try new things, and there's really a very fluid food sector there right now. So I think the potential, as people are thinking about where is there a niche that I could have a plant-based food company, or even do something that you know might be heretical to vegans of you know combining meat with plant-based products. China, I think, is a really interesting and exciting place for this, which is fairly neglected right now, and where your efforts could have a disproportionate impact.
But isn't China where meat alternatives were first developed thousands of years ago?
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
How does that play into the...
Well, I mean, I think this is why you're at a head start. I mean, there's an understanding that you can have a dish with tofu and pork in it together. Mm. And so it's not a big leap to have a dish with some pork and also some, you know, another plant-based meat. So I think it's just how do you take these traditional foods and make them more exciting, make them more accessible, and so on.
And at the Good Food Institute, we have about 15 white space companies. About 8 of them are going forward, and 2 of them have gotten funding. We just started, so GFI, for people that don't know, just started in February. So this bodes extraordinarily well, I think. But one of the white space companies is China. And I was chatting with people may or may not know, WildAid has launched a campaign in China working with the Chinese government. And they've got some ads with James Cameron and Arnold Schwarzenegger that are focused on cutting Chinese meat consumption in half. And I think it's largely a climate change focus, but the WildAid folks are happy to help with anybody who's got that entrepreneurial spirit and wants to figure out how to... They agree with our... I mean, we want to do whatever's going to be most effective, so if what's most effective isn't you know plant-based meat and there's some other way to fight for center of the plate space... that involves innovation, we want to do that. Although multiple people who we've spoken with who are in China, literally everybody who we've spoken with who was in China, thinks there's tremendous potential as the company develops, and the people of China want to be sort of more Western. A part of that is eating more meat. So allowing them to see more Western as eating more plant-based meat has tremendous potential, and we would be delighted to work with you on starting a company along those lines.
In some ways, I think the West is actually sometimes the most difficult place for vegetarianism to gain a foothold, in a way, because if you ask like a general audience, like who of you can like name me one culinary, one recipe, one dish, one main dish that they got from their grandmother, nobody can name anything in Western countries. And if you do that in China, India, Mexico, Japan, Middle East, whatever, they have a repertoire of vegetarian products, vegetarian recipes. So it's much more ingrained in their culture to like make that shift. So I think there's indeed a lot of potential in other cultures.
That's great. And I think that's you've all mentioned some really exciting developments. But it kind of made me wonder... sometimes this new technology can be very exciting and it opens up all sorts of new opportunities, but there have also been cases where people have been very suspicious of new technology. So I'm thinking of the ways in which genetically modified organisms, even the ones that have seemed to be very beneficial and low risk from a scientific perspective, have not ended up being widely implemented and rolled out and benefiting the world. So how can we avoid that problem happening with our new animal product alternatives and making sure that they do get rolled out and animal suffering is reduced because of that?
That's a really great question. And back to that workshop that I was talking about where we had people from Tyson, we actually had the CTO of Monsanto, Rob Fraley, talk to us about how he had learned in his 35 years of Monsanto what went wrong with science communications. And the lesson is basically to communicate as much as you can, as early as you can, and to bring people into even the part of your science where the answer is, I don't know yet. And that's a good idea, and we should investigate that. And that's part of why New Harvest has been so public about the kind of research projects that we fund and so adamant about keeping these early stage research projects open is because we want people to feel like they are part of it and to indeed become part of these research projects as well.
Yeah, one of the things that the Good Food Institute is doing is focusing on some consumer polling, because we figured now, years before you've got the product, it makes a lot of sense to start thinking about how we're going to discuss it. And for anybody, so we, on the basis of polling everybody who's working on cultured products and then doing some market research on it, are using the phrase clean meat to refer to tissue-engineered meat rather than cultured meat, and I would be happy to share our market research, and I'll be posting a blog probably in the next week or so that also talks about how we feel that clean is clearer. So for anybody who would like that, shoot me an email. My email address is on the gfi.org website under our team. The second thing is plant-based, of course, you know, is sort of a solution to that already because it's not scary to people. And then the third thing is just to say the clean or cultured meat technology is extraordinarily natural. So it's adding sugars to cells and causing the cells to multiply. And we believe that people eat meat right now despite how it's produced, not because of how it's produced. So once you've got a technology that gives them a product that doesn't have the bacterial issues, it doesn't have the antibiotic residue issues, it's transparent. Of course, right now, conventional animal product consumption, and they're actually criminalizing finding out what happens on these farms and in these slaughterhouses, whereas with the clean meat technology, as Isha is saying, it's a completely transparent process. So I think that's some of the messaging that we should be focused on. And in my experience, it seems to be resonating with people pretty well.
I think, too, that this is where advocacy can play a big role. I mean, you know, you look at Aqua Advantage salmon, and there was no advocacy about why this could be superior environmentally, why it could even be better for animal welfare. It was purely a company seeking higher productivity in its fish, and people didn't respond well to that. I think here there's a far more compelling story of a product that really could solve environmental and health problems alongside of massive animal cruelty problems. And I also think that the more attention we draw to current industrial factory farming practices, the more that people will realize that insofar as they have kind of a naturalistic ideal, it is very far from the meat they're eating today, and these products are really far closer to it. I mean, if you look at modern broiler chickens, although not technically genetically modified, they have been genetically manipulated beyond anything we would imagine as naturally being a chicken. So it really squaring up the comparison of the chicken that we're eating on a regular basis with the plant-based alternatives or the grown alternatives, and showing that one, in the ways that really matter, is more natural, is a more something that's more in line with our values than the industrial product that we're eating today.
I think if you talk about the advocacy movement, animal rights movement, there's still a lot of work to be done there because a lot of people in that movement are very much into organic, natural, and all these associations that they make with food. So I think basically what we have to do there is do the work of VA and the rationality work and spread the ideas also in that movement about appeals to nature and things like that. So, but there's definitely a lot of work to be done. But I can see it in Europe. It's shifting right now. I think, like for instance, the GMO discussion. I don't know if it's an international thing, but Greenpeace was recently called out for changing its stance about GMOs. They want Greenpeace to change its stance. So people are getting more open to the idea of GMOs, at least as not harmful and as potentially beneficial. But we are a long way off, I think, from having an attitude about these things that is really productive.
Yeah, I think these are all good avenues for us to be taking. But one other thing I want to point out is we really don't know which of these or whether all of these combined will be enough to ensure uptake. And so this is another place where, depending on your personal background, if you're like a social sciences researcher, you know that the social sciences are the difficult sciences, and they're the sciences where we don't know the answers. And one thing that could be really helpful is increased research on comparisons to other movements, like to what happened with the GMOs and how we can avoid that, and also with just basic social science understanding of how things propagate through society and what we can do to make this transition work well rather than going badly.
At the same time, the social science research is only as useful as the actual products coming to exist. And as you mentioned earlier, Allison, it's possible that we're not talking about direct replicas. We may be talking about a new form of protein, which is just so exciting that we've never thought of it before, in the same way that we never could have imagined cheese before fermentation turned it from milk into cheese. Maybe there's some form of meat that is created through culture, which is actually more appealing than the meat that we're familiar with. And how can we be testing that unless we advance the science first? And what we found is, since we focus so much on research as opposed to creating prototypes and things like that, there are interesting things that we discovered. So for 3 years, I assumed that cultured beef would have been the best product to move forward with first, because we're more similar to cows, and therefore we've done so much research on human cells that there'd be a lot of crossover. But what we found in our chicken cell project is that chicken cells are relatively unresearched, and what we figured out is that these chicken cells are actually much more plastic than bovine cells, which means that they have the capacity to multiply many, many more times than we previously thought. So, in fact, it is actually more effective to grow cultured chicken than cultured beef, and we could have never done that unless we had done these like exploratory research projects to get there. And that actually informs the kind of research we should be doing about acceptance. Maybe we should be doing research on chicken acceptance instead of beef acceptance, for example. So interesting things like that come from going through the research path.
So one of the morals of that story, Isha, I think, is that if you're doing anything in the clean meat space, be sure that New Harvest and GFI are looped. Because we would be very happy to work with you on study design or whatever.
Yeah, making connections between academic research and the actual work that people are doing on the ground is something that has been relatively neglected mm-hmm. between any part of animal advocacy and any research that's sort of related in any way. Mm-hmm. And being here at this conference, you have a really good opportunity to not neglect that. So don't. If you have any desire to be connected to some organization, just talk to anybody who's connected to some animal advocacy organization, and they probably have a web of contacts that they can put you through.
Great, thanks for that. We're starting to run slightly low on time, but I just kind of quickly want to ask, we've talked about a lot of exciting things and I like the optimism, but I also want to hear just like very concretely, what is some specific thing that you wish that was happening that is not yet happening, and how could it be started? Start with you.
I think what I wish was happening that I'm not sure is happening is connections between the clean meat and cultured meat people and the environmentalist movement, because I think that's the movement to really keep your eye on with regard to the potential backlash and the GMO type reaction. And it's also a movement which has really strong reasons to be in favor of cultured meat or clean meat if that comes to market. Mm-hmm. But I think it doesn't have as many ties as I would like to see.
Yeah, so I'm going to go a little bit off of what you just asked to say that the Good Food Institute, we hired a policy director. She's been teaching food law for the last 5 years. And first on her list is regulatory questions, so regulatory questions having to do with clean meat and various regulatory issues having to do with leveling the playing field for plant-based meat. But second on her list is outreach to the environmental and health community, and she's actually meeting this coming week with the Union of Concerned Scientists, Food and Water Watch, the Bloomberg School of Public Health, the Center for a Livable Future people. So, and then we have another person, a senior advisor, who's here actually, Melina, who's also working on those sorts of things. So we're trying to cover the waterfront. So if you have ideas for things that you think are neglected in the clean meat or the plant-based meat space, please see me or shoot me an email. In terms of neglected, I'm mostly just super excited and super enthused by the work that New Harvest is doing, by the work that GFI is doing, by the degree to which the animal community is adopting effective altruism principles more and more with regard to both decreasing maximal suffering and maximum meat reduction. I think the main thing that the clean meat community needs is money and talent. The main thing that, you know, GFI needs is money and talent. But I'll be very interested to see what everybody else on the panel thinks.
I would say the neglected area for us is definitely funding, because we have talent and they have incredible proposals. And if you're interested to see any of them, please get in touch with me. All that's missing from them is the funding for them. And these are projects that can lead to many, many more researchers getting involved and having the tools to advance this. So if anyone knows any philanthropists who are interested in doing something big, we have some really great proposals ready to go.
I think that there are some really exciting opportunities in thinking about the low-hanging fruit of reducing the demand for industrial meat. Two that come to mind. One is the food wastage issue, and this can be tougher with meat because most food waste with meat is post-sale, post-retail. It's at the consumer level that people are throwing it out. But there's been some really interesting work done in Europe where supermarkets stop doing promotions on chicken, for instance, where they relabel chicken to have a use-by date rather than a best-before date. They've dramatically reduced the amount of chicken being wasted. There are similar initiatives happening at the food service level. Low-hanging fruit, because it's completely uncontroversial to people that we shouldn't be growing chickens that we're literally going to throw away the meat of. The other low-hanging fruit, which may be a little more controversial, is some food service companies have started creating amalgam products, which are part meat and part plant-based. And this is a way, particularly for food service companies, but you could see a far more broader application, to work toward institutional targets of reducing, for instance, their chicken demand by 30% by creating products that are part chicken but have more plant proteins in them or more other plant-based products. And I think there are some really exciting things that can be done to further that movement.
I'd like to see more policy and more of a focus on policy and institutional change. And in particular, I think the avenue of changing the default option is a good strategy. As an example of that, when I fly home in a couple of days, if I want vegan food on the plane, I had to have indicated that on the website, VGML, that I wanted a vegan meal. But imagine you're a meat eater, you get on the plane and you are served a vegan meal, and then you protest and you said, like, I didn't order a vegan meal. And the flight attendant tells you, well, if you wanted meat, then you should have told us beforehand. So you turn around and you make vegan the default option. It would have a lot of advantages in terms of like an airline company. So that kind of policy change and playing with the default option of choice architecture is, I think, potentially very impactful thing in terms of behavior. And it avoids the fact that you will cut off people's choices. You won't forbid them to eat meat, which is something they're allergic to, but you will just make it more difficult to behave in the wrong way and make it more easy to behave in the right way. And I think that's a promising avenue that's not like being tried too much by the movement.
Great, thanks so much. That's a good, diverse array of answers. So let's, since we're running low on time, let's jump to some questions that you have hopefully submitted, and I can read them to our panelists. And then after that, we can close the session. So let's look at the question here is, given recent work in the field of meat replacements and cultured meat, what do you think the timeline of these projects are, and what do you think is the marginal value, is of working in this research versus other areas of animal advocacy? Kind of tried to get at that question, but now if you have anything else you want to add on, maybe do that now.
Well, people who want to get involved, we have job openings on our website, not just for us, but also for the field, which is just gfi.org/jobs. But we are hiring a business analyst, an innovation manager, somebody to do international outreach, and a scientific foundations liaison. So if you think this might be you, talk to me after.
Great. Since I think we kind of got at that, I'm going to go to the next one. So this says, if we can have much more of an impact on the far future than in the near term, is social change much more important than new technologies?
So I guess kind of thinking new technologies are going to come eventually, but what's important is potentially shaping the future and our morals and our ethics for potentially hundreds or thousands of years to come.
Yeah, but the ethics and the morals can follow the new technology. So I don't know which has to come first, if there's a necessary order in that.
I mean, I think it's critical that we focus on both the technological and the moral progress, because I don't think either of them is inevitable. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that there is a clear moral progress throughout history for humans, but for animals, things are probably about as bad as they've ever been. So although there has been great moral progress for humans, it hasn't reached animals. And absent effective advocacy now, there's no reason to suspect in the future that it would reach animals, or even that new technology would be used to alleviate animal suffering as opposed to increase animal mm-hmm. suffering. So I think there's an absolute need for moral advocacy on this issue now. There's also a need for technological work, because the technology too, as Isha was saying, is not going to just happen on its own. It's not 5 years without any work. It depends on how much people put work into it and what they do with that. The other thing I would say is that beyond farm animal suffering, I know for a lot of people, increasingly wild animal suffering is a concern. And on that issue, the technological solutions are far less clear. And so I think that's another clear case where moral progress will be needed, regardless of the technology, to ultimately solve some of those issues.
Although I think Tobias is right when he says that it's going to be an awful lot easier for us to make the moral progress if we're not, you know, dining on an animal's tortured body while we're having that conversation. So, I mean, there are a surprising number of people in animal protection who adopted a vegetarian or a vegan diet for health reasons or environmental reasons, and only then were they able to consider that they had been doing something ethically problematic for decades of their life. So mm-hmm. I do think they're mutually reinforcing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree that they're mutually reinforcing. I think that for me, while neither area of progress is inevitable, I think our society is much more set up to reward and encourage that technological process. Mm-hmm. And there's other forces besides altruism that are pushing it forward. There's profit-driven reasons for it to move forward. And so if we're the people acting out of a moral desire for things to change, then we should be a little more aware of the need for advocacy and moral activism, because there are other people who might not make that technological progress as quickly as we like or as completely as we like, but they are likely to take at least some of that burden from us. If that's not our personal area of comparative advantage, we don't necessarily need to work on it, even if we want it to happen.
Great, thanks. Hopefully we have time for one more question. Tobias mentioned a study in which people preferred the product that they were told contained meat, regardless of the flavor. The study also showed that the strength of meat preference was predicted by authoritarian values. Does this suggest that shifting values is more important than shifting tastes?
Yeah, I don't know. Good question. Like I said, I think they can go together, and like Bruce said, I remain of the opinion that shifting values will be so much easier after, when people are not a stakeholder anymore. Ideally, like Lewis said, we have to do these things together. I mean, taste and technology and the whole product development and advocacy, and they interact together, and that's the beautiful thing about it, and that's maybe why also we need more, well, initiatives like GFI, where we bring like maybe the advocacy side in touch with the business side, because there is an interaction between behavior and products on the one side and this values and advocacy on the other side, and I think sometimes they're not like linked enough, and I think there's something to be gained if we do that more.
Although I would point to plant-based milk again and just, you know, point out that an awful lot of cows were taken out of production, and with all the benefits that has in terms of climate change and sustainability and, of course, animal protection, and that happened based on markets and food technology exclusively. So there is a tremendous amount of good that can be done for animals, you know, just in that sector.
Yeah, and I mean, you talked about dairy having a 10% market share. It doesn't have much to do with animal values.
Yeah, that's my point. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah.
And it's, exactly. You know, it was 15 years ago. It was exactly where plant-based meat is now, and now it's 40 times the size.
Yeah.
You know, we do that with plant-based meat, and we save 3 billion animals a year, 1 billion land animals,
yeah,
and a couple billion sea animals.
Yeah, so I think those are helpful answers, but I worry about too much saying, like, we need both. Certainly, we do need both. I think that's, or at least both is better than only one. But to kind of sharpen the question, I want to say, like, on the margin, do you have a clear sense of which area we should increase our resources to? Obviously, it also depends on the comparative advantage of the individual or the type of resource, but do you have an overall sense of the kind of zeitgeist of where more should be allocated?
I mean, I think on that point that thinking within each of these spaces, which part of the moral progress and which part of the technological progress is neglected, I think as spheres in general, they're very neglected overall. But, you know, particularly if you look on the technological side, you have some companies like Impossible Foods and Hampton Creek that have done incredibly well in fundraising, and I think are having an amazing impact. But, you know, are relatively less neglected now as a result. Whereas you have areas, and I think certainly some of the companies that the Good Food Institute is trying to seed in areas like replacements for seafood or work in China, where it is still very early and still highly neglected. So if your comparative advantage is on the food technology side or the entrepreneurship side, that could be a great place to go and do things. I think on the advocacy side, there's also a lot of really neglected spaces. I mean, I think there's been a lot of vegan advocacy. I think there's still a lot more potential on what we can achieve for incremental reforms, through how we can reach institutions and get them to move more of their buying away from industrial animal products. So I think that there are niches to find on both sides that are neglected and tractable, and finding the one that lines up your comparative advantage is probably the sweet spot.
Yeah, I would be, I don't know for sure. I haven't spent a tremendous amount of time thinking about it. But if we're thinking about vocational fungibility, and if you personally have the capacity to be the next Pat Brown or Ethan Brown or Josh Tetrick, like you have that entrepreneurial spirit or you have the scientific chops to co-found a company and do something truly innovative in food, I'd be pretty surprised if that is a replaceable role and if there's something else in straight advocacy where your talents could do as much good.
I think if we're talking about philanthropy, then it is cultured meat research that is the most neglected by far, because these companies like Impossible, Beyond Meat, et cetera, are receiving a lot of funding, and that's not necessarily from an advocacy or altruistic source. So if these are people who really care about advancing the field, it would be in this research that requires funding and philanthropy in order to get to a stage where Impossibles and Beyond Meats of, you know, 2.0 can get out there.
Although, I absolutely am, you know, hope that clean meat, cultured meat, New Harvest will get tons of money. But I would just point out that if we had been having this conversation 5 years ago, none of us would have known about pea protein as a possible plant-based meat. If we'd been having this conversation 6 months ago, none of us would have known about pea protein as a possible plant-based milk. Right now, the most popular plant for plant-based meat in Europe is lupin, and probably unless you're like really devoted to this stuff, nobody in this room knew that, and it's animal feed, so it's really cheap. The alternatives are huge. So, I mean, again, plant-based meat, we know about it if we're, you know, vegetarians are sort of tuned in, but it's 0.25% of the meat industry. Mm-hmm. It's barely bigger than clean meat.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing just on Bruce's point, I would say it's absolutely true that if you're a good entrepreneur, you could be the next Pat Brown, you could have an outsized impact. It's also true on the advocacy side. I mean, if you can be the next David Komen Heide, who runs the Humane League, that I think he's had an incredible impact. I think there are a number of other advocates who have had a similar degree of outsized impact based on bringing a very strategic, smart approach to advocacy. And the movement is still so small, still so young, that there is the potential to have that kind of outsized impact on the advocacy side too, if that's where your comparative advantage is.
Great. I think that we're about at time. So thank you so much. And big round of applause for our panelists, please.